Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program Stefan Fatsis. Stefan, welcome back.
Good to be here, Vic.
Stefan, I feel like I'm having a flashback. I think the last time I interviewed you was about 10 years ago, and it was for this very same book. It's Word, it's Word Freak. What happened? It's out again.
It's never gone away, Vic, but it is out again. I approached my publisher, Penguin, who published the paperback, a year ago, and I said, you know, next year is the 10th anniversary of the publication of Word Freak, and sort of half-jokingly suggested, you know, maybe can we do a 10th anniversary edition, knowing full well that publishers don't do 10th anniversary editions. But they agreed, which was incredibly gratifying. I mean, it said to me that, you know, they appreciate the book and the fact that it's continued to sell steadily over the last 10 years, and they were willing to let me write another, you know, 40 pages and put a little note on the front cover that says 10th anniversary edition, and that's, you know, that's about all that an author could ever ask, to have a supportive editor and supportive publisher that see the value in a book.
I suppose we should give them the full title. It's Word Freak, Heartbreak, Triumph, Genius, and Obsession in the World of Competitive Scrabble Players. Stefan, let's go back to the beginning. How did this happen?
I was looking for something to write about, to be honest, and I was working at the Wall Street Journal as a sports writer at the time, and I sort of trolled around looking at ideas and things that I'd be interested in doing. I kind of wanted to do something that was participatory, hadn't done that before. And I stumbled across this world. I had always played Scrabble. I had never played it seriously, never memorized words, or went to clubs or tournaments. But I knew that that world existed. There had been a terrific Sports Illustrated article written by a guy named Scott Price, whose byline is S.L. Price, who is now a friend of mine, lives right near me here in Washington, D.C. And I knew that there was this sort of unusual subculture of Scrabble players. And I looked around, found the guy that ran the Scrabble Association and said, hey, can we play a game sometime? You know, maybe I'll write something for the Wall Street Journal. And I did that. And then I found the core group of competitive players in New York. And I fell in love with the game before I fell in love with the story and the possibility of a book. I realized that there was something in my brain that was built to want to be good at this, to compete and to play this game and to learn these words and to explore the nuances of language. And it took me about 2 years of playing steadily and going to tournaments and memorizing words and becoming a serious player before I finally sat down and said, all right, I'm ready now to do a book proposal. I wanted to be serious about the game and gain the trust of the people that would become the main characters in the book. And it took a long time to do that, and I'm glad that I took that time instead of just plunging in the way a lot of writers do. I feel like I was able to really get inside the world in a genuine way, and I think that makes better writing.
So you were still living in New York City, and one of the first things you did was you went down and you started hanging around in this park where there's some pretty hardcore Scrabble.
I did, and that's where I met some of the real great characters and where I experienced what turned out to be some wonderful scenes. Just a real eccentric lot. I mean, there was sort of a core group of sort of reformed chess players, these middle European immigrants from the 50s who would go to what were chess parlors in New York City, and Scrabble became an offshoot of chess in the late 50s and early 60s when these games players realized that this game was as strategically complex as chess was, and also you could bet on it. And that's always an important part of serious gaming. And so there were the core of older guys, there were these other, and there was almost all men in their 40s and 50s who were competitive players, went to clubs and tournaments, and there were the players that ended up being main characters in Word Freak there. And it was a great environment for me at the time. I was working at the Wall Street Journal. I had lived a very sort of yuppie existence and lived in Brooklyn and had my day job. And then on weekends, I would hop on my bike, ride over the Brooklyn Bridge, going to Washington Square Park, and have a day where I was in this completely alien world. You know, the people were different, the conversations were different, The vibe was different. The backgrounds were different. It was an escape for me in some ways, but it was also at the same time this wonderful journalistic opportunity to be in a place that hadn't been explored in depth, to meet people that were willing to share their lives and their interests and their unusual obsession with this game and language and words in a really naked way. And as a reporter, you don't get many of those opportunities in life. So many things are picked over. So many things have been written about to such a great degree that to be able to walk into a world that hasn't really been fully drawn out and fully explored and discovered is a gift that writers are, you know, you're lucky if you get one in your life. And I was really lucky to get this one.
Stefan Fatsis joins us. His book, Word Freak, has just come out in a 10th anniversary edition. I was like you. I grew up with Scrabble, and it's really a passion for me. I never allowed it to take over my life like some of these people that you have in the book. Some of these guys are really eccentric. And then you went back and you wrote your afterword freak, and you put an addendum on this book, and you caught up with a lot of these people and told us what they're up to. And, mm-hmm. and so much has changed in 10 years, particularly with the internet and the online presence of Scrabble. I was just amazed to think about it. After I reread your book, I thought, wow, 10 years ago, I don't remember that you could even play online Scrabble.
You couldn't if you were just a regular player at home. I mean, there was, for competitive players, there was a sort of an unauthorized, you know, this site that's still popular, that's basically operated out of a couple of servers in Romania, called the Internet Scrabble Club. I mean, anyone can play there, but really only hardcore players knew about it at the time. So there really wasn't an internet culture around Scrabble. You couldn't go on. There was no Facebook. There was no Scrabulous, which was a game that evolved in the middle of the 2000s that Hasbro, the owner of Scrabble, eventually shut down because it was illegal and cutting into their customer base, and they very, very belatedly realized that they needed to be more vigilant in protecting their trademarks and getting the people that were playing, hundreds of thousands of people that were playing Scrabble on a daily basis, to get them doing something that was owned by the company. So a lot has changed, and to my mind, that revolution has been fantastic. I mean, you got obsessed people who are not competitive players playing multiple games every day, exercising their brains, and part of what I write about in this afterword is about the corporate failures on the part of Hasbro to not exploit the digital age in a way that could have brought more people into the game, satisfied the hardcore players like me, and at the same time generated some money. They could have monetized it, and they failed to do that. So when you talk about changes in the last 10 years, there have been enormous ones, and a lot of it focuses on how the world has changed. And when you talk about the digital side, too, there are all these study programs and places you can go and anagram, and words are now really codified. It's much easier to become a good Scrabble player, to learn the thousands and thousands of words that you really do need to learn in order to compete at the highest level. And one of the most heartening things to me has been the emergence of a group of young people, 25 and under, down to, you know, to single digits, like my daughter, who's 9 and plays competitively now, who have been able to capitalize on the digital age and digest the words and the strategy and the nuances of the game and become wonderful players and invigorate this community.
And you're so proud she can do all those two-letter words.
I am.
My guest is Stefan Fatsis. The Agarwala brothers, what an elegant application. We'll talk about that later. Let's go back to the beginning.
Sure.
You take readers back to the invention of Scrabble and the history, and this is fascinating. I love the story of this guy who invented it, and then this other guy who had this monster on his hands and couldn't keep up with production and their little business agreements. It's just intriguing.
I loved that part of the research of this book. I found the great nephew of the inventor of the game. The inventor is a guy named Alfred Butz, and I got to spend a few days up at his offices in upstate New York, going through his uncle's boxes in the attic where he had stored all these prototype boards and tiles and papers. And it's just a wonderful American story. This out of work architect during the Depression, in effect, trying to keep himself busy and maybe come up with an idea that would help support him and his new wife. And the game was not an instant hit. I mean, the first prototype or the first antecedent of Scrabble was a boardless game that he invented in the early 30s. He junked that idea. He ended up getting some work in the late 30s, and then he revived it again, thought a board would be a good idea to help with make it interesting to players. And it wasn't until 1948 when he was approached by a businessman who had played the game and said, "Hey, maybe I'd like to try to give it a shot at marketing this thing." And the story goes that sometime in the early 1950s, in 1951, the chairman of Macy's happened to play it while he was on vacation and said, "This is one wonderful game. Why aren't we stocking it?" And Macy's put in a big order. That triggered other orders. And within 2 or 3 years, this was the greatest single rollout of a game in modern American history, greater than Monopoly at the time. In 1954, Scrabble sold more than 4 million sets. And it was just a wonderful piece of Americana. I went back and looked at advertisements and magazine and newspaper articles, and read about how the Queen Mother was visiting New York and bought a game of Scrabble, and it really evoked for me this nostalgic feeling of post-war America and the kinds of things that capture the public's imagination and contributed to this idea that leisure time was important. Americans didn't have that, but Scrabble was one little piece of that story in the post-war decade.
And some of us, just a few of us, become obsessed with it. And you dip into that obsession and you introduce us to these individuals who are thoroughly obsessed. I love the story. I think you're in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And you have a shirt on or some sort of placard or identification.
Carrying a bag.
Yeah, it says Scrabble on it. And some homeless guy comes up to you and goes, "Oh, yeah, I was in the national championship."
It was one of the most jarring moments of my Scrabble odyssey. I'm standing on the corner waiting for a bus to go to the airport, a shuttle to go to the airport. And this guy literally, just like you described it, Vic, he comes up to me and says, "Oh, yeah, I played in the 1981 National Scrabble Championship." And he starts telling me I played against Joe Edley, who's one of the main characters in the book, and I know so-and-so. And he's pushing a grocery cart. And I walk away, and I simultaneously thought, "Oh, my God, I'm in too deep here. Is this where this could be heading? Am I going to be the guy standing on the corner, muttering words under my breath? Or is this just one of those wonderful coincidences in life that makes you appreciate doing weird and different things?" And I went and looked the guy up, and lo and behold, absolutely. He had played in the national championship, and he was a serious competitive player, and he had multiple degrees from incredible institutions, and he had a nervous breakdown in his 20s, and this is where he had ended up.
He was an MIT guy, I seem to recall.
Right, that's right.
You introduce us to these amazing, wacky characters, and you kind of become one yourself, because as your ranking goes up, you start getting really wrapped up in it, don't you? Didn't you lose a game and you went running out of the tournament swearing?
That was the only time I wrote about it in the book. It happened multiple times. But absolutely. I mean, I found my identity being bottled up in my rating in the Scrabble world. I was spending the vast majority of my time studying words, playing games, trying to become good, and simultaneously doing interviews, conducting research, writing notes. I was completely immersed in this in a way that most people aren't. I mean, as a journalist, I was full in because I was writing a book and trying to master something. And, I think we all have this latent obsessive quality somewhere inside us. And I had been someone who had kind of restrained it my whole life. I never had a passion or a hobby like this one. I was pretty straightforward, newspaper reporter, loved my job, loved moving from one story to the next, loved traveling around and meeting people and writing about issues. But this was something that was very, very personal. And, as a writer, that was helpful to be able to craft a narrative. I think writers have to be believable, and my experiences had to feel genuine, and they were genuine. And I'm still, to this day, I am still very aware of my standing in this world. And it's changed because I wrote this book and it's influenced people in this little world. And I'll never have to apologize for winning or losing a Scrabble game in my life, because everybody that plays at a competitive level appreciates the contribution I made with this book. But at the same time, it gnaws at me when I don't do well. I just played in the National Scrabble Championship this summer, and I won 7 out of my first 8 games in the second division, and then I had a terrible losing streak in the middle and put me out of contention for the top finish. And I was distraught by it. You know, I ended up recovering toward the end and won, I don't know, 17 out of 17 wins and 14 losses. But I felt empty afterward, even though it was this wonderful week where I did a book reading and people were incredibly supportive. And all these young people that I had helped bring into the game did extremely well in the tournament. And yet I walked away from there feeling like that was my chance to do something great. And I didn't.
Stefan Fatsis joins us. His book is Word Freak. It's just come out in a 10th anniversary edition. There are so many aspects of this book that I really enjoyed. And one of them is that you actually tell us all these words and you show us the boards and you talk about the way the games unfold and the way that they were played. And we get to meet these people. I think my favorite guy in this book is G.I. Joel.
Joel Sherman is a former national Scrabble champion, former world Scrabble champion. He still, to this day, directs the Scrabble Club in Manhattan. He has never really worked as an adult. He's always had some maladies that have kept him from day jobs, from the GI gastrointestinal issues that earned him his nickname to other various ailments that he says prevent him from holding down a steady job. You know, he had a little inheritance, lived with his dad who passed away, and I write about that in the afterword of this book. But Joel is one of the most nakedly passionate and honest people I've ever met, Scrabble or not Scrabble. But in terms of the Scrabble, it makes him this wonderfully compelling character. He's sort of a sad sack-looking guy. Health is not great. He's small, a little hunched over. And he is so sympathetic to me. He's this wonderful, charismatic figure in this world. Brilliant, but also so candid that he sometimes puts people off. And pretty funny, too. He started off at this national championship winning 14 games in a row in the top division. And then he ended up losing much worse than I did in the second half of the tournament. And I just wanted to go over and hug Joel. I just felt terrible for him. But he is a brilliant mind who has applied his brilliance to this game. And I think that's one of the things that I love about this world and all subcultures, is that you can look at it. And I remember people would say to me, you're doing a book about Scrabble? I mean, what are you going to write about? But there are all of these wonderful little worlds in the world that people are so crazy passionate about, and that also reflect the outer reaches of the human brain and the different applications of the human brain. And that's one of the things I looking back on this book and the experience, that still just fill me with wonder. How do you do this? How does the brain work? What inspires a 10-year-old or a 20-year-old to sit down and memorize 50, 100,000 words in the service of solving this mathematical riddle that this guy Alfred Butz unwittingly created more than 60 years ago.
And some of these unique individuals associated with the game weren't able to really play. There's a guy who apparently passed away a couple years ago who was just a word nut, and it was heartbreaking and tragic to hear in your afterwards that this guy passed away and left his apartment full of his word lists, and they were destroyed.
Yeah, this is a guy named Joe Leonard, and he was instrumental in helping create a couple of the revisions to the Scrabble Dictionary, which was first published in 1978, and then there were updates done. We're now on a fourth edition of this dictionary. And Joe was just an obsessive compulsive. I mean, he clearly had he was ill, and he's sort of a recluse, stayed in his apartment. He rarely left, but he had the bizarre, you know, we call it a Rain Man type quality, where he could just pour through lists and compile these arcane lists, and it wasn't just words; it was all kinds of facts. His apartment was packed with these arcane dictionaries, and he would check for errors and compile lists and send them to publishers. And in effect, that's what he did in Scrabble. He corrected the work of the lexicographers and the Scrabble players who had compiled these dictionaries. He was meticulous and perfect, almost, in everything he did when it came to these lists. It was just the most astounding afternoon that I spent in his apartment watching him explain to me what he did and how he did it. These little slips of paper with words on them that he would cut out and alphabetize and put in plastic bags and then compile these single-spaced lists typed out. And when I heard about Joe's death, it took me a few weeks to find somebody who knew him and who cared for him, and it turned out to be a neighbor who had cared for him in his last years. And yeah, I was on the phone with him, and I said, and I didn't want to bring it up right away, and I said, you know, what about Joe's papers? Because in the Scrabble world, people were actually wondering, you know, had he done the same thing from the last edition of the Scrabble Dictionary? Had he made these corrections? Mm-hmm. Had he been compiling lists from other books? And when the guy on the phone said to me, you know, I just couldn't keep it. It was too much. They wanted to clean the apartment out. I actually nearly started to cry.
Oh.
I was heaving. I could feel my chest, air coming out of my body, knowing sort of the intellectual value, maybe only to a few of us, but there was this intellectual property, this value that had been lost. And that's sad. It's just sad.
I think some of our listeners might be shocked to know that the epicenter of competitive Scrabble is now in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
They're playing English language Scrabble there, correct?
Correct, absolutely.
And that's where the really awesome players are, in places like Malaysia and Thailand?
A lot of incredible players. Yeah, Thailand, where English was never the second language, this was not a British colony. And Scrabble emerged because basically of one guy in the 1980s who sort of created an underground company and produced rip-off Scrabble boards. A Mattel separate company owns the rights to Scrabble outside of North America, and so he was violating their copyrights, but he did it anyway and built a business and got Scrabble into the school systems. And if you go to Thailand now, and I've never done this and hope to it someday, they'll get thousands of school children playing in a championship, in a tournament, all at once. It's completely bizarre. And so you now have these incredible Thai players who barely can speak English but have memorized the words, which to them are merely letter strings. They really are devoid of meaning. Not only do they lack meaning, but the rest of what we associate commonly with words and word knowledge doesn't exist for them. How you conjugate it, what the etymology is, meaningless to them. But they know what the correct sequence of letters is. Spelling is even probably the wrong way to put it. But yeah, and then there have been some active businessmen who have Scrabble players who have come up with ways to persuade governments and businesses in this part of the world to hold these gigantic tournaments with prizes of $30,000 or $35,000 in some cases. And so combined with there's a rift in the world of language too in Scrabble. You have a separate dictionary that's used in North America and a more expansive dictionary based on a British dictionary that's used in the rest of the world for competitive Scrabble. So a lot of American players now want to go learn the international dictionary so they can go over once or twice a year to Malaysia or Thailand and play in a big tournament that offers a lot of prize money against the other best players in the world. It's a fascinating split that says something not only about the English language and its flexibility and its the ability of people to learn it, but also about the nature of games and the nature of this game. I think people at home tend to think of Scrabble as a word game. Who's got a better vocabulary? Who's more nimble in terms of finding clever plays? When in fact, it's a math game through and through. This is about probabilities. And it's about geometry and about the brain's ability to take and order information rapidly. And at the highest levels, that's what Scrabble is. And you can do that whether English is your first language or not.
Well, I confess, I'm a Collins nut, and I think we need to go that way.
Wow, I'm impressed, Vic. You know the Collins Dictionary is the basis for the international Scrabble Dictionary. It's a combination of what's in Collins and what's in the official Scrabble Players Dictionary, the word list we use in North America.
I'm obsessed with Collins. And Stefan Fatsis has joined us. He's the George Plimpton of Scrabble. Is it true, Stefan, that you proposed marriage over a Scrabble board? Is that true?
Actually, not over a board, over two separate racks of tiles. I made my wife anagram the proposal before I would accept it. So
Okay. Conveniently,
will you is seven letters combined, and marry me is also seven letters. So it was the perfect Scrabble proposal.
I get it now. I didn't quite understand that. You allude to it at the very end of this new 10th anniversary edition of Word Freak, and now that's a wonderful story.
Thank you.
I have just one more question. What's your rating right now?
Do I have to admit that?
Yeah.
All right. When the original book ends, I achieve my goal of becoming an expert-rated Scrabble player. My rating is about 1733. Not about. It was exactly 1733 because Scrabble players know these things to the digit. That put me in the top 10% of Scrabble players. And in the last 10 years, you know, I got married, I had a kid, moved, job. I have all kinds of excuses, but ultimately I sort of stopped studying with the same rigor that I studied when I wrote the book. But I continued to play because I am part of this world, and my rating trickled down and trickled down and trickled down. And it is now below 1500. My rating is, I think it's 1479, and that's embarrassing to admit publicly. But it also says how much this game has evolved, too. You can't just be a casual show up and play in Scrabble tournaments without preparing. It's like anything in life. You know, you better be ready when you strap it on and get out there. Not much different from football. If you're not prepared, you're not going to succeed, and I haven't succeeded. So, but I did better at this last tournament, the national championship, and I've been studying regularly now. And one of the reasons that I can do that is I can study on my iPhone.
Uh-huh. Well, Stefan, it's always a pleasure.
Likewise, Vic. Listen, thank you so much for having me on.
You've been listening to the Book Nook, and our guest has been Stefan Fatsis. His book, Word Freak, Heartbreak, Triumph, Genius, and Obsession in the World of Competitive Scrabble Players, has just been issued in a 10th anniversary edition with a new after Word Freak. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening. Speaking of Thailand, tune in next week when we'll be interviewing an author who actually lives in Thailand. He was in the United States to attend the BoucherCon convention in St. Louis, and we tracked down Colin Cottrell and talked to him about his new crime novel, which was inspired by a strange malapropism once uttered by former President George W. Bush. The book is called Killed at the Whim of a Hat. We'll be speaking to Colin Cottrell next week in the Book Nook, right here on WYSO. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.